Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Welcome to another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable. We hope you enjoy the conversation and do let us know what you think. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk and leave comments on our Facebook page, Premier Unbelievable, or tweet us at UnbelievableFE. For many more resources to help both believers and skeptics to explore faith, please visit our website, premierunbelievable.com. Registering there will unlock access to all content on the website, as well as giving you special access through the weekly newsletter to exclusive content such as bonus videos and ebooks. That's premierunbelievable.com. And now, here's today's Unbelievable Classic Replay, hosted by Justin Briley from 2016.
We're really looking forward to what we're doing on the programme today, asking, is belief in divine punishment good or bad for us? Dominic Johnson is the author of a new book, God is Watching You, How the Fear of God Makes Us Human, published by Oxford University Press. While drawing on his background in evolutionary biology, as well as psychology and neuroscience, Dominic makes the claim that religious belief in divine reward and punishment tends to arise across the world at all times in all societies, and it can be a very good thing for encouraging morality and cooperation in societies. But does that mean that belief in divine punishment is simply in our genes? Is it true or simply about survival? And I suppose, you know, survival of the fittest. And is Christianity ultimately a religion of divine punishment and reward? Those are some of the things we'll be discussing on today's programme. And coming on the line to interact with Dominic today is Peter S. Williams. Now, he doesn't claim to be an expert in evolutionary psychology or social anthropology, that kind of thing. But as a Christian who is a philosopher, he's got some questions he'd like to put to Dominic as we explore his thesis on today's programme. Also, a little disclaimer, I have asked Peter to come on at very short notice for today's show, so he hasn't actually had time to read the book entirely, but has read other things written by Dominic on the subject and some reviews as well. So we're going to be having a friendly chat on this whole issue of divine judgment, divine punishment, I should say, or the belief, at least, in divine punishment, whether that's been generally a good or a bad thing for society, what it would mean for a society that lost its belief as well in divine punishment. So a very warm welcome to you both, Dominic and Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you both on the programme today. Let's start with you, Dominic. This book, then, what inspired you to write a book on the sort of evolutionary origins of belief in divine punishment?
Well, it came originally out of my interest in the evolution of cooperation, which is a big topic of investigation in evolutionary biology and also in economics and other fields. And we still haven't quite worked out exactly how we achieve the levels of cooperation we do in society. It seems obvious. We sort of observe it every day. But how do we actually explain the emergence and maintenance of cooperation? And one of the things that turns out to be very good at promoting cooperation is punishment. So if you generate costs for not contributing to society or not cooperating, then it may make it beneficial to cooperate after all.
So that's a bit like the carrot and the stick approach, that in general the stick is more effective at getting people to behave better than the carrot approach.
Well, part of the book is investigating that hypothesis, the idea that there might be something special about the negative side, about the stick, which has a special power. But the starting point was really the observation that punishment is well established as a good way of promoting cooperation. But there hadn't been much thought about whether beliefs in supernatural punishment might achieve cooperation. and how that might play into evolutionary narratives about the origins of human cooperation.
I'm obviously asking you to summarise a very large book in a very brief way, but what overall was your sense then about the reasons why belief in, you know, different religions have a belief in divine punishment? Do you see that there's ultimately a kind of evolutionary explanation, a kind of this cooperation that it engenders behind it?
Yeah, so that's the hypothesis, that we know punishment in the laboratory, in public goods games, for example, can be very effective at increasing levels of cooperation and keeping them at high levels. And maybe that's true for beliefs in supernatural punishment too. So the idea is that given the individual benefits from higher levels of cooperation, religious beliefs might have actually helped us achieve higher levels of cooperation in the past and over evolutionary history.
And that's down to the fact in some way that if you believe there is a God watching you, and that it's just possible that if you do something wrong, which you know to be wrong, that might result in some kind of punishment in the afterlife or in this life, that you're more likely to make the right choice, the moral choice, the choice to, you know, share your resources with your neighbour or whatever it may be.
That's right. And this is the crux of the argument, because from an evolutionary perspective or an atheist perspective, you might question why you would have this apparently false belief or costly belief. It takes time and resources to engage in religious rituals and practices and beliefs. So why wouldn't that be stamped out by natural selection? But the argument is that even though it might be costly, and even if it's false, there might be an benefits of curbing our own self-interest and promoting our cooperation. And that's simply that if we're a little bit too selfish in a sophisticated gossiping society, we might incur costs as well as benefits of that selfish behaviour. So it's really an idea about curbing self-interest for our own good.
Now, there might be some who see the title of the book and hear what you're saying there, Dominic. God is watching you, how the fear of God makes us human, and think, well, it sounds very much like you're sort of doing what another well-known atheist, Daniel Dennett, did in Breaking the Spell, explaining how we're all just essentially wired to believe these things. It's all product of evolution, but there's no actual truth in it. Now, where do you fall on that? Do you think that you are explaining away, in that sense, where these religious beliefs come from?
No, I wouldn't say explaining away, and here's the difference. So Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins draw on some of the same underlying psychological research on the dispositions towards religious beliefs that we all have as human beings. But they then argue that it's kind of an accident that it's grown to be such a powerful phenomenon. It's a sort of meme
a
that
misfiring,
has spread.
Sometimes it's called, isn't it?
Yep. Or in Richard Dawkins' terms, a sort of parasite of our minds.
A virus.
With what he argues are broadly negative consequences. But my book takes a very different stance and says, let's take that same evidence and think through the adaptive logic of these beliefs and whether they might bring benefits rather than costs. So it tells a different sort of scientific story about the evolution of beliefs as good rather than bad.
I mean, I was interested to find out in advance of the program what sort of faith commitments you have, if any, Dominic, and you've said I'm an atheist, but I'm not a new atheist, as it were.
Right.
But nevertheless, as an atheist, I guess you are naturally going to be looking for a naturalistic explanation for the way that religious beliefs arise, because presumably you don't believe there is a God out there doing any punishing.
Right. So there would be other ways of addressing this whole issue, but my way of coming at it was from an evolutionary perspective. How far can we get in explaining and understanding religious beliefs from an atheistic standpoint, from an evolutionary biologist standpoint, where we're trying to account for beliefs which, on the face of it, appear to be costly?
I mean, does your book have anything to say, though, in a sense about the existence or not of God? Or is it that simply another subject altogether, as far as you're concerned?
I think it would be another book. What I do say is that this theory about religious beliefs having an evolutionary origin suggests a plausible alternative. So it means we don't necessarily have to invoke God to explain what are otherwise difficult to understand beliefs. But it doesn't directly speak to whether there is a God or not, of course.
Well, it's a really interesting book. I've been enjoying flicking through it, and there's all kinds of different angles at which you approach this question as well, and we'll try to get to some of them at least in the course of the programme. My other guest joining us on the line is Peter S. Williams. He's been on the show a few times, of course. He's a Christian philosopher, and as you say, Peter, at the outset, we want to say you're not an expert in this area, and you haven't even actually had time to read the book fully. So you're very
not.
I'm sure you will do. But nonetheless, you're the right kind of person, I think, to engage with these kinds of issues a little bit. So just what's your overall kind of response yourself, Peter, to this whole question of coming up with evolutionary explanations for our religious beliefs?
Well, I appreciated very much the fact that Dominic is distinguishing his approach from the approach that he mentions from new atheists like Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins, who do make this move from trying to provide an account whereby religious belief is natural in some sense, and then trying to use that to undermine the truth of religious beliefs. That's a move of critiquing the truth of something due to an account of how belief in it arose in the past. And that's a move that philosophers call the genetic fallacy. It's a well-known fallacious way of trying to undermine something. So I appreciated that Dominic wasn't doing that. And so I thought his take on this issue was a lot more sensible than the new atheist kind of approach on it, and therefore interesting to engage with and interesting to point to as a sort of counter to the new atheist approach to this as well.
I mean, when it comes to divine punishment, do you see, just from your perspective, that this has been an important aspect of religious belief, both in Christianity and, I suppose, in other major world religions down the centuries?
Yeah, well, I think it's right to acknowledge that belief in divine punishment plays a role in Judaistic belief, in Christian belief, in other religious beliefs. I think there's, you know, people like Dawkins will sort of often mischaracterize, say, the moral argument for God that Christians would put and say, oh, it's all about, you know, you've got to behave because otherwise, you know, God will punish you in hell kind of a thing. And yes, that's a mischaracterization of the moral argument. But certainly, Christianity does mention the possibility of punishment in an afterlife. Judaism had the covenant between God and Israel, which had a lot about, you know, if you follow these rules, then it will go well with you in the land. And if you don't, you know, they end up getting exiled to Babylon and so on. So I think God in those religious traditions uses both the carrot and the stick. And it is sort of a natural part of our moral psychology, I think, and perfectly reasonable and rational from a religious viewpoint to say that, you know, God has designed people in a certain way. We have a certain psychology and belief in certain aspects of religion, at least, come to humans naturally just as beings created in God's image. I think where I'd start to have questions would be how far can you push Dominic's theory in terms of accounting for some of the detail of religious belief? Things like, well, why believe in God, a personal God who's going to do the punishment, rather than, say, an impersonal process of karma, which is still a religious way of believing that, you know, your actions here and now might have serious consequences for you, you know, in the next life rather than in the afterlife. What about religions that don't, as Judaism didn't at the beginning, actually even sort of really believe in an afterlife, or at least an afterlife in which your actions here and now would make much of a difference to how you ended up and so on?
I mean, just as well, before we come back to Dominic and open this up, it is a common objection I find when I'm sometimes interacting with atheists who say, well, it's all very good, Christians saying I'm, you know, being good and being do-gooders, but if you're doing it because you're either A, worried about a punishment if you're not good, or because you think there'll be a reward on the other side of heaven if you are good, it's not really being good. And often they'll say, I just prefer to be good for goodness sake. What's your response to that, Peter?
I think it puts me in mind of C.S. Lewis's response to an aspect of this in saying that people will sort of say Christians are doing things for mercenary reasons, but he says it's not really mercenary if you think of yourself as a human designed to flourish best in a relationship with God, that that's what you're designed for, and that you are hoping for that in an afterlife. It's no more mercenary than someone who, you know, falls in love with a woman who asks her to marry him to hope that she actually will, and you'll live in the benefits of that, and that those benefits might be something that motivate you to work at the relationship.
That in a sense answers the reward aspect. But in your experience, are Christians also motivated by fear of the you know, hell and punishment if they don't do the right thing, or is that a misinterpretation of Christianity? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think, of course, Christianity brings in much more of an emphasis on forgiveness and grace. And again, that would be an interesting thing to ask Dominic, how that would feature into his theory. It sort of seems that you almost go from a belief in a God who punishes, and it sort of evolves, as it were, into a belief in a God who will forgive you even if you do wrong. So, you know, how do you account for that? But I think our moral psychology has sort of multiple sources, as it were. And there is something to the belief in the desire for justice, say, and that people won't get away with things if you believe in the possibility of an afterlife. Whereas if you don't, and there's no sort of moral accountability in the end, if our moral actions in the long term make no difference to our destiny, there is a sense in which that is undermining of our natural sense of morality, perhaps.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. Lots already that we've opened up here for the discussion today. Be interested in hearing your thoughts as well as we carry on today's show. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, as I mentioned earlier. The Facebook and Twitter ways to get in touch, of course, available too from the show page. Why not listen back to today's show, send it on to someone else, or start subscribing to the podcast as well. All available from the webpage of Unbelievable at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today on the programme, we're asking, is belief in divine punishment good or bad for us? Well, Dominic Johnson has written a book, God is Watching You, which suggests maybe it has been very influential in the development of cooperation within society. But ultimately, it does come down to an evolutionary explanation for that belief. And so that raises questions about whether these types of religious belief can simply be explained by evolutionary processes and so on. Be interesting to touch as well on what happens when we start to ditch the belief in a divine justice or divine punishment and so on. What do you make of those, Dominic, who say, yes, well, your book exactly illustrates what's wrong with religion, because it has been used as a tool for suppressing and oppressing and controlling people by threatening them with hellfire over the years and that kind of thing. What do you say to those critiques of divine punishment?
Well, I think it can be used for those ends, and it often is. So a current example is the leader of North Korea is thought to be some sort of god, and very interestingly, apparently some North Koreans are brought up to believe that he can read their thoughts from afar. So it really takes on some very interesting characteristics of God. So clearly, you don't have to look very far in history to find examples of where religion is used as a tool of oppression or coercion. But I don't think that's the whole story. So take someone else like Louis XIV, who saw himself as a kind of god, but at the same time was an incredibly pious man. So I think leaders can use religion to their own ends, but they can also be genuinely devout as well.
Because there's a sense in which if you do live in a culture where the power all rests in the hands of the rich and powerful, if they had no one to answer to, they might, I suppose, potentially run riot and do exactly what they want. If even the powerful, though, have a belief in ultimate judgment, that might be a restraining sort of effect upon them. Is that what you're saying?
It could be. I mean, I don't argue in the book that there's a sort of advantage to leaders necessarily being or holding religious beliefs. And in fact, if anything, I try and get away a little bit from the questions of social hierarchy, because if we go back far enough in human evolutionary history, you don't have strong social hierarchies. So now I'm talking about hunter-gatherer societies, which were the kinds of societies we lived in the Pleistocene, about 2 million to 10,000 years ago, when things like language and theory of mind first emerged, and presumably the first forms of religion emerged too. And in those societies, they were very egalitarian. There weren't clear leaders. There weren't strong social hierarchies. So I think in terms of the origins of religion, the use of religion for oppression or coercion is sort of not relevant.
I want to encourage you guys to sort of have a conversation at this point and come back and forth. I mean, Peter, do you want to put that question you had about whether Dominic's thesis accounts for, you know, the fact that, well, why wouldn't karma or something equally be preferred? Do you want to ask that question, Peter, just so that I don't misrepresent it for you?
Yeah, sure. So Dominic, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the kind of specificity of the supernatural beliefs that you think your theory would account for. So there was obviously quite a lot of differences between, say, believing in a personal God who might punish and in an impersonal force like karma. Would they both seem to do the evolutionary job, as it were, equally well? And if so, how could evolution account for people's different belief in those things?
Absolutely, yeah, it's a great question. And of course, the book sounds like it's all going to be about God and Christianity. But in fact, the book really takes a very global and cross-cultural view. And it does argue that karma and other forms of supernatural agents or agency do the same job. So yes, they're extremely different, extremely complicated. There's many, many differences between different cultures and different religions. But you do find beliefs in supernatural punishment as quite a recurrent phenomenon. I call it a common denominator. And karma does the job very well. It's perhaps more strict than God because it's so mechanical. If you do something bad, you accumulate bad karma. If you do something good, you accumulate good karma. And there's no sort of tweaking the system, as it were.
There's no grace, which could mean you sort of get let off a certain amount of your karma. You have to work it off in that
as
sense.
I understand it, that's right. And so that's, you know, another of the big major world religions. But you find that elsewhere as well. So the Iroquois Native Americans, for example, had this concept of Arenda, which is also a impersonal force, which also had the same role of consequences for good and bad deeds.
Peter?
So one common criticism of these sort of evolutionary explanations of belief and so on that people like, I read one review of your book by the atheist John Gray in The New Statesman, sort of saying that these kind of evolutionary explanations are sort of untestable. Are you able to sort of make predictions on the basis of the theory, such as, well, a belief in a strict karma would seem to fulfill this function more efficiently than a belief in a God who might, you know, be bribed into letting you off or might give you grace? Therefore, can you show that a society with one belief is kind of outperforming in some sense another? Are there any historical evidences of, say, societies that don't believe in any form of supernatural punishment being outcompeted in survival terms by meeting a society who does? Is this a sort of a just so story, as some people would say, or can you put it into contact with historical evidence?
I mean, can I read out, just for the benefit of those listening, overall, I think, a very positive review of your book, Dominic, what atheist John Gray did say on that front? He said, Johnson argues evolution will ensure that the religion that prevail will be those that enable social cooperation by promoting a belief in supernatural punishment. The trouble is that this is a blank check rather than a falsifiable hypothesis. No one has ever identified a mechanism of selection amongst religions, and it's unclear whether any such mechanism would operate on individuals, social groups, or some combination of the two. These are problems that beset all theories of cultural evolution. Yeah, what's your response to that critique, Dominic?
Yeah, well, it's first of all a very important question, and as a scientist by background, that's exactly what we want to do next. So we come up with a hypothesis and then we try and test it. And there are some good answers to this, so it's not necessarily easy. But for example, one study I did was to use a cross-cultural database of pre-industrial societies. And there's 186 of them from all areas of the world. And I looked to see whether there was an association between whether those societies believed in more or less moralizing gods and the extent of cooperation one finds among them. And there was a correlation. So societies that were more likely to believe in moralizing gods or whose gods were more moralizing, as characterized by anthropologists, were more cooperative in many ways. They tended to be larger, which is very important. Getting to be big as a society is a big challenge. They tended to have central sanctions, police, to use and loan money, which requires a lot of trust, and to pay taxes, which also suggests a sort of social level of cooperation. Now, studies like that are very complicated. There's all sorts of other things going on. But it was at least suggestive that the hypothesis that moralizing, punishing gods somehow are able to promote cooperation is at least plausible. Other kinds of evidence include experiments in the lab with people today, and asking whether if you prompt them with religious ideas, does that improve their cooperation or not. So there are ways of addressing this from an empirical point of view.
And I'm assuming the tests have shown that that does happen when people are, I guess, people are less likely to steal money in the church than they are in the workplace or whatever it might be.
So just to give you one example, I mean, I think theologians would have problems with these kinds of experiments, but just as a fun example, Jesse Bering, a developmental psychologist, did a nice experiment where he made people do a maths test, and he told them there was a glitch in the computer and that it might present the answer to them. And if that happened, they had to quickly press the space bar before they could read the answer. And then they had two groups, and in one group, they told them that there was a story in passing. They told them there was a ghost thought to be in this building. And it turned out that the treatment group where there was supposedly this ghost in the building were much less likely to cheat. Now, that's just one example, and I can give you more. Yeah, but yeah. There's certainly efforts to try and investigate this possibility that sort of supernatural agency somehow affects our behaviour.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to you, Peter, in the next section of the programme. We're already out of time in this first section of the show. We're talking, though, on today's edition of Unbelievable about whether belief in divine punishment is good or bad for society. Well, many a new atheist, to coin the term, would say, well, of course it's bad, you know, control, power, domination and so on. That's what it's always been used for. Not necessarily, says Dominic Johnson in his new book, God is Watching You. In fact, there may be all kinds of benefits to believing in divine, if you like, rewards or punishment in the hereafter. But what does that actually mean for Christian faith as it stands today? And do Christians believe in that sort of system of rewards and punishment? We'll perhaps get into that as well and hear what Peter S. Williams, our Christian guest, has to say on the matter after a short break. You're listening to Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking. Hopefully, we're certainly doing that today on the programme. Do join us again in a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's show. I'm Justin Briley. Unbelievable is the programme that aims to get you thinking, and we have lots of both Christian listeners via Premier Christian Radio, but we also have a lot of non-Christian listeners who pick up the podcast on a weekly basis. And wherever you are, however you're listening around the world, it's great to have you with me as we discuss whether belief in divine punishment is good or bad for us today. My guests are Dominic Johnson and Peter S. Williams. Just a reminder that later on in the show, you can hear some feedback to recent editions of the programme. You can also find loads of past shows and extra features, the blog, videos and much more at the website too. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Later on today, as part of Faith Explore between 4 and 5, there's also the profile still to come. Rahil Patel tells his story of being a Hindu priest and how he converted to Christianity. That was only a few years ago. Really interesting story he has to tell later on after Unbelievable is finished. But let's get back into today's discussion. Dominic Johnson joins me, author of God is Watching You, How the Fear of God Makes Us Human, and drawing on his background in evolutionary biology as well as psychology and neuroscience. He makes the claim that religious belief in divine reward and punishment tends to arise across the world and is a very good way of encouraging morality and cooperation in societies. But does that explain away religious belief in some sense? Is it true or simply selfish, I suppose, in the end thing about survival? And what about Christianity as a religion of divine punishment and reward? We'll be discussing those kinds of questions. Peter S. Williams, Christian philosopher, is joining me as well on today's programme to talk this through. Peter, having heard again from Dominic in that last section about some of these interesting experiments that have been done that seem to suggest that people do act more morally when they believe there's some sort of supernatural agency involved. There's lots of areas in which Dominic does feel that his thesis is borne out. What are some of the other questions you wanted to ask him, though, in regards to this whole area?
Okay, well, we've had a response to Dominic from one of two criticisms that the atheist John Gray puts in his review of his book in the New Statesman. So I think it'd be interesting to put the other issue that John Gray raises, because it was an issue that put me in mind of a quote from C.S. Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain, actually. John Gray mentions about a belief in the ancient Greek pantheon of fickle gods who were often at variance with each other and so on. And yeah, in the introduction to The Problem of Pain, I'll just read this little paragraph from Lewis and see what Dr. Johnson makes of it. Lewis says that in many forms of paganism, the worship of the gods and the ethical discussions of the philosophers have very little to do with each other. And the third stage in religious development arises when men identify them, when the numinous power of which they feel awe is made the guardian of the morality to which they feel obligation. Of all the jumps that humanity takes in its religious history, this is certainly the most surprising. Perhaps only a single people as a people took the new step with perfect decision. I mean, the Jews.
What's he getting at there then, Peter? Just explain what the thought is behind that quote.
So Lewis's thought, he seems to be talking about a sort of an evolution of religious ideas, but saying that in our accounts of paganism, say like the ancient Greek religions, as Gray points out, you have these sort of capricious, very fallible, often immoral gods that have very little to do with the sort of discussions of morality and politics and so on that would go on amongst the Greek philosophers, and that it seems to be a unique contribution, as it were, or a contribution most fully taken, according to Lewis, to combine these two things, to say that the supernatural religion is also to do with the moral. And he says that was the sort of innovation of Judaism.
And that is significant in some sense, because it suggests there was a step change at some level in the way people viewed God and God's justice and unchanging nature and so on.
Right.
At that point, which perhaps marks out the, you know, what happened thereafter as distinct. Dominic, do you want to come back on any of this? I mean, do you tackle at all in the book the more capricious Greek gods who perhaps you never quite knew where you stood with them, you know, whether you were good or bad? You know, they tended to do what they liked anyway. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I do have a small section in the book where I talk about Greek religions and Roman religions as well, and and also the idea of capricious gods. And I talk about the Book of Job. Of course, within Christianity, we also have this problem, because God is not always consistent in linking up punishment necessarily with bad behavior. I think the big picture point from my perspective is that the argument is that religious beliefs in supernatural punishment promotes cooperation. Now, that cooperation need not be moral. So, for example, the Nazis were very good at cooperating with each other. I'm not saying religion necessarily had anything to do with that, but it just illustrates the point that people can be very cooperative, but with nefarious ends.
Sure. Mm.
So the book is really about, does belief in supernatural punishment change people's behavior such that they are more likely to conform with whatever the social norms might be in that society? And when you start looking around the world, some of the expectations of good and bad behavior are very different from our own. So we have to be a little bit relative about, you know, what moral means.
Mm.
Having said that, I do argue in the book that on the whole, belief in supernatural punishment does seem to promote moral behaviour rather than immoral behaviour. So I do at some point have to tackle the problem of the Greek gods. And one way of looking at it is, like any theory, you don't expect it to explain everything. Human societies are incredibly diverse and complex, and we should expect instances which don't quite conform to the general pattern. The other way of looking at it is that it's a bit like my argument about pre-industrial societies, that the Greek gods may not have been about promoting morality necessarily, but it was about promoting certain forms of behaviour which the gods either preferred or did not prefer, and people nevertheless were motivated to change their behaviour accordingly. Mm. And that's interesting.
Mm. Yeah, yes. I mean, what about this view that Peter quoted from C.S. Lewis, that there was something distinct and different happened with the advent of Judaism? Do you see that as, you know, do you follow the same view of the evolution of religion, that there was a distinct way in which people right. started to see God from that point onwards?
Yeah, I think so. And I should mention that this book is sort of one of a lot of books recently on evolutionary perspectives on religion. And it's become almost a consensus among that group of researchers that there's a very important change in human evolutionary history between the small-scale egalitarian hunter-gatherer societies I described earlier, which ended about 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture and the Neolithic Revolution. And the last 10,000 years have been incredibly different because human society suddenly became much bigger. Mm. And what everyone seems to agree on is that when societies became bigger, religions had to become more about morality, because suddenly we were trying to promote cooperation, not among friends and kin that we all knew, but among strangers that we might never see again. Mm. And in order to promote trust and cooperation in those big societies, we needed what some people are calling big gods to go along with it. Gods which were moral and made us do pro-social things rather than anything. It had to be things which promoted cooperation and reduced self-interest in order for the group to work.
As we've said, Peter, you're not claiming to be an expert on the social anthropology and all that, but what's your response overall to that kind of view, that bigger numbers meant you had to have bigger, fairer gods to ensure the right kind of morality developed in the bigger group?
Well, I think that's very, very interesting, and what Dominic's saying about religious sort of belief in punishment in general promoting cooperation, and then one having to think about the link between cooperation and morality, that the one might support the latter, but that they're not identical concepts, but certainly I don't think religious person necessarily need to have any problem again with saying that, you know, God has designed us in a certain way, however he arranged for us to come about. We have a certain design to our moral psychology and so on, and that belief in justice, in punishment and so on, linking God to that would be conducive to us living with reality in the way that reality yeah. actually is, from the religious person's point of view. You know, from the religious person's point of view, these things are true, the possibility of punishment, etc., is true, and acknowledging that would help you live in reality the way that yeah. it is.
I mean, what I'm getting from you there, Peter, is that, again, I suppose going back to this thing of showing that there is a correlation between believing something and the evolutionary benefits it brings doesn't necessarily give you explain away that thing, the genetic fallacies, it's called, so that it could equally be taken as, well, there you go, science shows that living the way God prescribes for us is good for us, in fact.
Yes.
It
would be a little odd to think that living the way God designed us would be bad for us.
Sure.
As it were, from the religious viewpoint. Yeah.
What's your take on that, Dominic?
Well, as we sort of discussed before, I think the problem is that a lot of these important questions come at the end of the book. So yeah. yes, this is all very interesting, and it offers a sort of plausible empirical account of why these beliefs might have evolved and why they might have helped us. But when you start asking the question, well, the meta questions of who created us, what's the purpose of life and human beings, and the meaning of existence, then it's just a whole other set of questions. And I'm not quite sure that an evolutionary account necessarily speaks to that directly.
Sure.
Interestingly, what I have found is that theological questions like those Peter's raised are grounded in Christianity, typically. Mm-hmm. And the book is very much trying to avoid only addressing Christianity and looking at all of the major world religions and all of the religions that we find in small-scale societies, indigenous societies around the world as well. So one thing that's become interesting to me is whether these evolutionary accounts match well with Christian theology as opposed to, say, some other kind of theology. And I think that's an area of research that very few people have started to engage with yet.
I would like us, in a sense, though, to remain with Christianity as that sort of the thing we tend to debate most on this show. And in that sense, Peter, I think another question that you had to bring to bear in this is the question of whether, I suppose, A, there may be other reasons for believing in the claims of Christianity and religion, other than ones that could appear to have some kind of evolutionary advantage or whatever. But I suppose there's also, for me, that question of, when I think of Christianity, I don't automatically think of that religion which basically punishes you if you do wrong and rewards you if you do right. Actually, my view of what Christianity is about, a view that in which you can get a completely clean slate, however awful you've been in your life. On your deathbed, you could say sorry and be granted the kingdom. And that, to me, I suppose, goes a little bit against the whole thing in a way, because it seems like actually that if that's possible within Christianity, then maybe there isn't such a big advantage to being good, to escape punishment and so on. So, I mean, do you agree with that, Peter, before we come back to Dominic?
Yeah, I think that the thing that Christianity brings to the centre, which is often sort of mischaracterized again often by new atheists as a sort of belief in what you might call extrinsic rewards and punishments for behavior. It's the sort of punishment like, you know, if you park on this double yellow line, then we will fine £100. That's extrinsic punishment. It could have been, we'll make you do community service for 3 hours. It could have been anything, but there's just some punishment attached to it. I think Christianity focuses much more on kind of intrinsic results, the intrinsic results of wanting relationship with God or rejecting relationship with God, and God offers you in the forgiveness displayed in Christ a basis for having a relationship with God, which is, you believe, the relationship that you're designed to have as a being, that is the relationship in which you will therefore most flourish as God's creation. But there's still a focus within that upon the results of the way in which one is living, whether it is a flourishing, virtuous way of life as you put on the character of Christ and so on in Pauline terms, or whether you are frustrating the eternal purpose of your life and so on.
I mean, I get the sense from what you're saying, Peter, as well, that Christianity, by and large, tends to be viewed as by the people who practice it as about your forming of your moral character in as you kind of live in this relationship with God. Now, it's not so much about avoiding punishments as seeking something that is, in that sense, positive.
I think it's about seeking to take part in God's good overall plan for the creation that he has made and the creatures that he's made in it. It's about contributing to the total good, the summum bonum, as Thomas Aquinas spoke about. You know, God is the greatest possible being, and he's got this wonderful plan for creation, and we want to take part in that and do our bit in it, and that's the good thing to do. So, yes, in a sense, it's about looking at the results, good or bad, of what one is doing. But it's much more in Christianity in the context of pursuing the good and pursuing and enjoying relationship with one's creator. And yes, that's on the basis of forgiveness for sin and the offer of help in transforming one's character to become more and more what God intends it to be.
Does your thesis on divine punishment take into account that kind of way of understanding Christianity, would you say, Dominic?
Well, I can see one interesting point of crossover here, which is that one can think of this theory as sort of extrinsic punishment. There's a thing up there in the sky which strikes you down or punishes you. But I do talk in the book about the internal cognitive mechanisms underlying these kinds of beliefs. And one very interesting thing is, from an evolutionary perspective, why do we have certain secondary emotions like guilt and shame, which religions are very good at eliciting? And it seems that there's very good evolutionary reasons why these types of emotions have evolved. On the face of it, you might think they would be against our self-interest. You know, why feel guilty or shameful if you're just trying to pursue your own self-interest and get ahead?
Sure.
But it turns out that guilt and shame are very important sort of social moderators of our own behavior. If we experience guilt and shame, then we're more likely to behave effectively and appropriately in society and benefit from that. And these proximate mechanisms are, in fact, the drivers of our behavior. We're not planning to, you know, have more children or accumulate more resources necessarily. We're actually, on a day-to-day basis, pursuing much more, I guess, what I would call, and Peter might agree, intrinsic rewards or intrinsic consequences. So we're following those desires, if you like, at the very proximate level. But the consequences are something sort of beyond our immediate horizon. That's an interesting point of crossover, because it suggests that there might be an evolutionary basis for some of the ideas about intrinsic religious motivations, such as salvation and avoiding sin for its own sake.
Peter?
Yeah, I think that's is indeed an interesting point of crossover there. It would be interesting to read what you say about that in your book. Yeah.
Just coming back to you, Peter, for a minute, when it comes to you, your belief in God, now I'm guessing you're not going to say, you know, well, I've got my belief in God because of my evolutionary history and it's adaptively useful for me to believe in God, and so I'm essentially a product of my evolutionary heritage. You presumably have some other reasons for why you believe in God. So to what extent, you know, is it useful to have these sort of reasons that Dominic gives for why beliefs might arise and be generally used in society? And how much should we weigh them against other beliefs, that other reasons why our belief in God and Christianity might arise?
Yeah, well, in philosophical argumentation, philosophers often talk about the importance of intuition in establishing the places that we argue from, in order to argue to other conclusions. But we often start from things that are just sort of natural or intuitive or just sort of seem cognitively obvious to us. And I think it's perfectly possible to say these sort of evolutionary accounts are just pointing out those things that are just seem obvious to us or are intuitive to believe to us. But I think you can also sort of say, it would be restrictive to simply and only look at those sort of accounts in order to explain religious beliefs. So I have some questions about exactly what detail of religious beliefs that kind of account would account for. It wouldn't account for religious beliefs that are particularly grounded in, say, particular religious experiences or particular claims about divine revelation historically speaking within Judaism or Christianity. They certainly add layers to the supernatural beliefs of people that are based in particular experiences religiously, historically, and of course, you know, looking at philosophical argumentation and so on, just using the rationality that we have, we can also think through sort of philosophical argumentation, the cosmological argument, the moral argument, the design, etc., etc. And that all these things point together in a certain direction, I think is the thing that gives you confidence that you're in the right sort of worldview, religious ballpark.
And so I don't get from you particularly that you view Dominic's thesis as in particularly as an objection or in any way a refutation of Christian
belief.
No,
I don't think it is. I think Dominic's made it clear that he doesn't think it is. It's the new atheist folk like Richard Dawkins who mistakenly try and use this kind of account in that way, but that's a misuse of this kind of account, I think.
And you're happy to say that as well, Dominic?
Yeah, I think so. I think that it's a separate question as to whether God is real or not. As an atheist and an evolutionary biologist by background, my sense is he's not real. But I haven't answered that question in the book. The book has only given a plausible evolutionary account of how and why these beliefs might have arisen in terms of natural selection.
Are you an atheist then who would say, as I meet other atheists who would say this, I don't personally believe in God or go to church, but I'm very happy that people do, because I do think it serves a good sort of purpose in our community, in our country, and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. The key sort of take-home message of the book is that in today's world, religion is used for good and bad ends and has good and bad outcomes. But in the whole spectrum of evolutionary history, it seems to have been extremely important and on the whole, a very important driver of pro-social cooperative behaviour.
So what's going to happen if, you know, in the West at least, as is happening, the church is in decline and more people say they are non-believers, don't believe in God? If we are going in the direction of less and less people believing in any kind of ultimate divine sanctions or justice or punishment, whatever word you want to use, is that going to have a negative effect, in your view, on our willingness to be moral and cooperate in society?
Well, it seems as if that should be the conclusion, doesn't it? But I think the difficulty is that we are finding things to replace that aspect of religion. So if we're going to make the argument that religion is an important in terms of maintaining social order, in the modern world we have democratic governments, police, courts, jails, laws, which serve that purpose. They don't replace religion in other ways necessarily, but they might replace the bit of religion I'm talking about. So I don't think we can expect the breakdown of cooperation or anything. What I do argue in the book, though, is even though that's the case and we have these new methods of maintaining and sustaining cooperation, there could be something about religion which is especially effective. And without it, maybe we'll find it harder to keep everyone moral.
I mean, you talk about the fact that with the advent of CCTV and constant surveillance, you know, it could be argued that we're almost we do have a society where everything you do is seen. But it's still not quite there. So there's a sense in which it'll never be as good as the God who can even see your very thoughts and motivations, if you like.
Precisely. So police are pretty effective, but they're not always around. God is always around. God is omnipotent. The police are limited in their powers of observation and punishment. So there are some sort of qualitative, for the believer, qualitative but massive differences in the power and potency of gods versus secular forms of punishment and law.
What was interesting to me as well was reading bits in the book where you talk about atheists. I think you quote from Alan de Botton, for instance, who still, even as atheists, have a kind of a sense of I'm if I do bad things, I'm probably due something bad in return, or swings and roundabouts, and some sort of an idea that isn't necessarily logically part of what they should be believing as atheists, but they nevertheless still have some kind of view of karma or divine justice going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for raising this point, because it's absolutely essential to the book, is that if we all have these underlying cognitive mechanisms which predispose us towards religious beliefs, they are often manifested in religion, but they tend to be manifested in all sorts of other ways too. And he was one of many examples in the book of people who quite willingly and rapidly admit to a feeling of comeuppance or just deserts or a just world. And it may not be on the forefront of everyone's minds, but perhaps particularly when there are high stakes, something really good happens or something really bad happens. It's interesting that people do very quickly start to consider the possibility that there's some sort of supernatural order punishing them or rewarding them.
Yes. For you, I guess you would say that just shows how deeply rooted in our evolutionary psychology it is. I suppose. Peter Williams, though, would you say it actually shows some kind of divine spark about our natural inclination towards believing we do live in a world of ultimate justice or something?
Well, it's certainly consistent with that hypothesis, isn't it? To say, well, that just reflects the fact that people are made in God's image and do have these deeply inbuilt sort of intuitions, moral intuitions and so on, that do sort of naturally lead one to believe in that direction. I think to those who would sort of downplay the importance of belief in punishment in our moral psychology and so on, just talking about modern society, I think back a few years to the riots that we had in Britain and the various people set fires to various buildings and things, and that for a few days the police didn't seem to be really out there on the streets, and a lot of people took part in looting.
Mm. People who wouldn't normally necessarily have taken part.
Yeah. And when asked, you know, well, why did you loot? That, well, the basic answer that they often gave was, well, because we thought we could get away with it, because the police were clearly not stopping it. No one was going to stop us. We thought we'd get away with it, and so we had at
yes,
it, nicked
indeed.
The telly or whatever.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll finish up this conversation on divine punishment and whether belief in it arises from a sort of purely evolutionary forces, or whether there is a sort of inbuilt divine spark, I suppose, that compels us towards having that sense of conscience and so on. But we'll continue and wrap this up in a short moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Hope you've been enjoying the discussion so far on Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. We'll be back in just a moment's time. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, brought to you as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. I hope you've been enjoying the discussion, and we'll be wrapping it up in a moment's time, this question of whether belief in divine punishment is good or bad for us in the long run, with my guests Dominic Johnson and Peter S. Williams. What's coming up on the show next week? Well, I did promise last week what should have been on the show today, but in the end couldn't make it happen. But we are going to do it next week, and that's a discussion on whether Christians are happier than atheists. Sort of not that, you know, quite kind of related in some ways to what we've been discussing today, isn't it? But we're going to be looking at research that sometimes seems to suggest that people with religious beliefs or within religious communities are generally happier than those without them. And Anne Morrissey, a sociologist who's a Christian, will be joining me, and an atheist writer, Craig A. James, to discuss that question. So if you've enjoyed today's discussion, you'll probably enjoy next week's as well. That's at same time, 2:30 here on Premier Christian Radio and online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. A little later on today as well, I'm going to give you some more details about the Unbelievable and Christian Skeptic Discussion Group that meets regularly in London. And funnily enough, their next meeting very much picks up on some of the aspects of today's discussion as well. So listen out for more details of that. Plus, of course, we'll be reading out some of your emails and what you said on Facebook and Twitter about last week's discussion, where we played devil's advocate, Michael Roos and Randall Rouser, swapping sides, each trying to defend the other's worldview. That was an interesting programme. So we'll get some of your feedback on that too. And don't forget that later on today on Premier Christian Radio, between 4 and 5, you can hear The Profile. And today it's Rahil Patel telling his story of having been a high-profile Hindu priest and how he, through an extraordinary series of events, became a Christian not that long ago, only a few years ago. So listen out for that a little bit later on the programme. Right now, though, back into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So we've been asking whether belief in divine punishment is good or bad for us. Dominic Johnson, the author of the new book God is Watching You, How the Fear of God Makes Us Human, has been talking about his thesis that essentially the belief in divine punishment has had this evolutionary advantage, creating cooperation, especially in large groups of people and societies. And that perhaps is an explanation of how this belief has become so widespread in a number of different religions. And on the line with Dominic, Peter S. Williams, who's a Christian philosopher, doesn't claim to be an expert in this area, but has asked some very, I think, probing questions as to how this relates to the lived experience of Christianity, and whether it, in any sense, explains away God. And I think what both agree that this doesn't necessarily do that, though it's obviously it could be seen as consistent with an actual God who kind of sets up the order in that way. Or equally, if you are an atheist, it gives you a plausible explanation for why that belief, which, as you've said, Dominic, could be seen as a problem. You know, why would we go to the trouble of believing in a God who punishes us potentially? What advantage could that confer? It's rather costly, but you say actually it does have this advantage. I mean, as we mentioned at the end of the last section there, of course, in societies which are increasingly secular, one wonders, well, as that belief in ultimate justice, divine punishment, is lost, what does that mean for society as a whole? And I think the book touches on some of the areas, for instance, in Scandinavia, and what that might look like in the future. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, briefly. So there's a sociologist called Bill Zuckerman who wrote a book called Societies Without God, and he went to live in Scandinavia to ask precisely this question. So how do societies get along when no one believes in God anymore? And of course, the first thing he found is that it's not true that no one believes in God anymore. Church attendance has declined and official religious affiliations have declined, but it doesn't mean that people have stopped believing.
No.
In some things. So there's all sorts of interesting personal beliefs that people have. Some of them do claim to be out and out atheists, but many of them actually admit to believing in some form of supernatural agency. But the other point is that, of course, society doesn't break down. They work extremely well. So it does suggest that you don't need large-scale organized religions for societies to function perfectly well. But the empirical question remains, what is it that people carry on believing?
I mean, often when we've talked about this area of whether secular societies are function just as well as Christian societies and so on, so some Christian guests have been keen to point out that many secular societies are, at some level, riding on the coattails of what were Christian societies and the values and so on that those instilled, and experiencing in some sense the afterglow. Does that kind of figure into this? I mean, is it too early in the stages of these secular societies to know whether the cooperation that still seems to be working will continue?
Yeah, I think it is too early, really. We might not have very long to explore it, because I think if you look at the broader perspective of demography around the world, you'll actually start to question secularization anyway. Mm. There's some research suggesting that the proportion of religious adherents in the world has actually increased over the last 100 years. And then also we have all sorts of revisionist movements and fundamentalist movements, which are very powerful as well. So yes, in the West, we're experiencing this secularization, but it's not representative of the world as a whole.
Indeed. There's a sense, I'm sure I've seen surveys, the Pew Research and so on, which suggests that the reality is, if the trends continue, atheism itself will diminish and potentially disappear if simply by the logic of the way other religions are growing and the rate at which they're growing.
That's right, and secular states in the West are some of them in decline. We're reproducing extremely slowly compared to many religious societies.
It's interesting stuff. I've really enjoyed today's discussion. It's been nice to kind of be able to draw out some detail some of these aspects of the background to this study. Peter S. Williams, as we start to finish up our discussion, any thoughts as we start to draw things together?
Just one Bible verse that springs to mind here from Paul's letter to the Romans. In chapter 2, verse 15, he talks about the consciences of Gentiles who don't have the law and don't believe in the God that Paul does, but talks about the way in which they show the requirements of the law are written on their hearts. Hmm. He says they're simply because of the fact that they're made in God's image. So although a decline of explicit belief in God might to some degree undermine morality and cooperation, perhaps one would expect on a biblical basis that people would have these moral intuitions and intuitions and feelings about guilt, about punishment and so on, which are very naturally interpreted within a theistic context. But even if they don't explicitly interpret it that way, people are people and are going to have this moral sense, are going to have this sense of guilt when they do things that are wrong and so on. That I think
is there a sense in which that moral compass that perhaps is written in our hearts can nevertheless be dulled, the more that right. There is no compulsion on them to be moral, that people can get used to the idea of being selfish, not looking out for others' interests.
You can certainly sear the conscience, and society as a whole can certainly go in a downhill direction. But as you say, we'll just have to see historically how that actually pans out for societies that go in that direction. But it's not as if as soon as you stop believing in God, it's not possible for you to believe or do the right thing. That's again a mischaracterization of sort of the moral argument that new atheists will often make, right, saying that Christians say that non-Christians can't know the difference between right and wrong, or sure, can't be good people. Well, of course they can, and the official biblical position from Paul is that of course they can. But as you say, it is also possible for humans to dull their consciences and to pursue evil to the point where, as Paul says, they start recommending it to one another and endorsing and celebrating those who outperform each other in being evil.
Mm. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion today, Dominic. Any final thoughts you want to leave us with before we wind up?
Absolutely. Just perhaps a counterintuitive point of consensus that if Paul suggests that we have this moral sense which should pervade whether or not we carry on believing in a particular religion, I think Darwin might say exactly the same thing, that the point about this is that we do seem to have dispositions towards religious beliefs as part of human nature, and those underlying cognitive mechanisms will stay whether or not we still recognise religion in society.
There you go. Darwin and St. Paul, natural bedfellows, obviously. But Dominic, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today. It's been really interesting to have your perspective today.
Thank you very much, Dominic.
And thank you, Peter, for being willing to come on and have the conversation as well.
Pleasure.
Well,
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you both. And again, if you want to get in touch, well, I'm going to give you the ways to do that in a moment's time. Dominic's book, by the way, available from Oxford University Press. Global.oup.com is where you can find it and search for it, or just type it into Google equally. PeterSWilliams.com if you want to find out more from Peter and his writings and speaking and research and so on. All of those links available as usual from the Unbelievable website of today's programme, PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as ever, if you want to get in touch with the programme and tell me what you thought of today's discussion, then email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and do follow us on Facebook and Twitter. At UnbelievableJB is the Twitter handle, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. If you want to get in touch via the Facebook page, see what I post there on a regular basis as well. All those links and, of course, today's show available from the Unbelievable website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. And I am going to be reading some of the comments that have been left at the website and on the Facebook page in regard to last week's programme. Really interesting discussion last week where we flipped things around and the atheist defended theism and the Christian defended atheism. It was our devil's advocate programme. Before we get to that, though, and some of your responses to those shows, let me just remind you that the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group is meeting in London. That's at the William IV Pub, 7 Shepherdess Walk, on Monday, February the 8th, just over a week's time, between 7:30 to 9:30. And it's very much a place for Christians and skeptics to join together for dialogue and discussion. They'll hear a speaker and then discuss it around tables. And the speaker on that night is Alan Duval. And he's going to be, as an atheist, explaining why he believes religious beliefs arise, particularly monotheistic religious beliefs. In fact, quite a lot of tie over into this kind of subjects we were discussing today on the programme. So it's interesting to see that they've picked a topic that obviously we've to some extent broached in today's show. So if you want to find out more about that, you can go to the meetup.com website. Look for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group in London. Let's go to some of your comments in regard to recent programmes. Firstly, Andrew gets in touch about last week's show, and just to remind you who the combatants were, though they were very friendly and genial combatants, weren't they? It was Randall Rouser, our Christian guest, and Michael Roos, our atheist guest, but In this devil's advocate debate, Michael was defending a theistic point of view, belief in God, and Randall was defending atheism. And I wasn't sure how it went, but it was great fun. And we've had loads of great response, actually, on Twitter and Facebook and elsewhere, saying how great both guests were at trying to really represent the other person's position. So Andrew, who is a guest from the past, Andrew White, and involved in organising these Christian and Skeptic discussion groups that take place regularly, says, just listening to Randall and Michael's Devil's Advocate show, wow, this is similar to the suggestion I made recently to the Skeptics group, so much so that Ed, the other organiser, emailed me to say he thought I was on the show again. What I had actually put to the group was inspired by Dave Tomlinson, who once had a Skeptic group himself. What I put to our group was for the Christian to say 10 things he hates about his faith, and the skeptic to do the same. In effect, being honest about the problems and issues in both. When I put that idea to the group at the end of my talk on the history of hell, a Christian there about my age put his hand up and said, I'm a Christian, and I'm just so scared of the notion of living forever. And he meant with God in heaven. And next to him was sitting a very articulate and intelligent atheist, and he said, gosh, I'd love to live forever. It was a surreal moment for the whole room, to say the least. We're hoping to get both of those guys to talk, likely in March or April. That sounds interesting. Thank you, Andrew. Keep us informed. Jim Chung gets in touch about that Devil's Advocate show. Says, I'm a long-time follower of the show, listening by podcast for the past 6 years now. I was once an atheist, but became a Christian during my college years, and your programme has helped sustain my faith through many doubts and stormy times. Reflecting on the recent podcast between Michael Roos and Randall Rouser, I was struck by how eloquently Roos was able to wax poetic while defending what I consider to be the heart of Christianity. And it occurred to me just how many of my theological heroes, be it Augustine, C.S. Lewis, or Alistair McGrath, were once non-believers who converted to Christianity. They have a unique perspective that allows them to be incredibly effective at narrating the gospel in a way secular audiences can appreciate. If only Roos could be persuaded to switch teams, what a powerful witness he could be. Thanks for all you've done for Christ's kingdom, Justin. Keep up the amazing work. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate you getting in touch. Hey, it's never too late, Michael, if you're listening. Prayson in Denmark says, hi, Justin. I was looking forward to hearing Roos and Randall exchange on the case for and against the existence of God. Randall Rouser did a brilliant job in presenting contemporary problems of God's goodness and supposedly indifferent world. He showed that theists are quite aware of such challenges, but do find them wanting. I don't know what to make of Roos's devil's advocate position. He is brilliant, and I do love and respect him. But in this talk, he didn't do justice to articulate theistic cases for the existence of God. His response to Randall's case, namely Hickean soul-making type theodicy, was weak at multiple levels. Due to space, I'll mention just one thing. His response did not address the divine command killing of the Hittites, the Amorites, and the Canaanites, the Perizzites, and so on. How could such killings contribute to soul-making of individuals or societies? Now, if I were Roos, I would show Randall that the understanding of God is richer than our modern views that are trying to make God attractive by undressing him of his sovereignty, holiness, justice, wrath, and jealousy, and so on. If God gives life, then he can take it as he sees fit. Unlike us, we don't give life. Thus, in most cases, it isn't ours to take. And assuming that God exists and he is creator of all, then it's not strange that God does directly or indirectly through illness or the sword, etc., take lives. He takes and gives life all the time. There's nothing new there. If we also assume that God is holy and righteous, then it would follow that he has justifiable reasons for doing so. Yes, even when he kills infants. I guess that's the kind of point of view that people like William Lane Craig would defend. I'm not sure Randall himself, though, who was, you know, the Christian, if you like, debater in last week's show, would take that view either, actually. Michael, I guess we weren't asking Michael specifically to defend an evangelical inerrantist perspective of Scripture either. So that's perhaps why he wouldn't have gone down that line, because we didn't specify what kind of a Christian sort of worldview you have to defend. Indeed, it was more a theistic worldview, if anything, that Michael was defending on that programme, wasn't it? And that's what other people have picked up on today as well. For instance, Scott Ward over at the Facebook page of The Unbelievable Show says, interesting debate. However, I was surprised by how badly Michael did at playing the role of the Christian compared to how well Randall did at pretending to be the atheist. Just goes to show that most atheists don't understand Christianity very well, and reasons for atheism are not so difficult to grasp. If the pretend Christian in this debate truly understood the Bible and Christianity, he would have known how to defend the God of the Old Testament just as well as he can defend the God of the New Testament, and not draw his opponent away from the suspicious to most morality of the God of the Old Testament. Well, Joel responded to that comment and said, I don't think that you were quite fair to Michael there, Scott. The position that Michael was given to defend wasn't Christianity, but basic theism. And I'd actually say that Michael did a better job at supporting theism than Randall did at supporting atheism. Randall made the mistake that people like Sam Harris often make of making arguments against only a particular type of God rather than the idea of God in general. Michael made much better arguments for the existence of some sort of God than were made against God. Whether or not his interpretation of Christianity would be considered orthodox or not would only be relevant if it was an atheist versus Christian debate. Randall had no obligation to defend a literal interpretation of the Old Testament because believing in a literal interpretation, I think you meant Bruce here, a literal interpretation of the Old Testament is clearly not a necessary part of being a general theist. And Steve Pond came in to agree with that, though saying he actually thinks that Mike Roos has a better grasp of Christianity than some Christians. So there you go. Again, I'd say, yes, it's one thing to ask an atheist to defend theism, but to then ask them to defend a sort of very particular view of Christianity would be probably a step beyond that and would have been perhaps too hard for Michael to sustain that, though I think he did do a very convincing job of of a kind of general kind of mere Christianity, maybe, that he was prepared to sort of more or less defend on the show. Anyway, thank you very much for those comments. Just going to some comments from the underneath the programme itself on the website. DeandBJ13, he's a regular commenter there, and said, besides the entertainment value, one of the reasons that were given for doing a show like this was that it's important for people to fully understand the position of the other side. There's a belief that if you can't argue the other side, then you don't really understand it. I don't disagree with that. I'm not really on board with the other reason they gave. It has to do with empathy. If you can argue another person's position, you can better understand where that person's coming from. Once you're empathetic to their position, then your discussion tends to be less combative. And personally, my style of debate is to argue the issue, not the person. He says, coming as a surprise to no one, I don't believe that debate has to be friendly and a genteel exchange. It doesn't need to be unkind, but it also doesn't want to be watered down for those with a weak digestion. If we're going to debate deeply held belief, let's not hold anything back for the sake of feelings or sentimentality. And while I don't condemn the devil's advocate style of debate, I could never engage in one myself. I argue passionately about things I believe in and care about deeply, and my goal is to reveal truth or as close to an approximation of it as I can. I don't want to argue like a lawyer, and the purpose of that type of debate is merely to win. Yes, I see what you're saying there. I don't think it would be for everyone putting themselves in the devil's advocate position, DNBJ13, because some people simply couldn't sort of reconcile themselves to arguing for something they fundamentally didn't really believe in. But it was, I think, an interesting exercise to undertake anyway. And thank you for leaving your comments. Tony Vance on there says, OK, may I declare Michael Roos did win the debate. I hope that Michael realises that he now has a fan of his great theistic debate skills. I wonder if Michael realises that he seems to affirm Paul's point that within us all is a realisation that God exists. Also, I appreciate his honest assessment of Christianity and his own upbringing. Jay Webb, meanwhile, said it was a good show. I'll say with zero hesitation, Michael and Randall both made better cases for their adopted counterpositions than at least half the unbelievable guests who actually hold them. I was especially impressed with Randall. Michael always seems like a halfway Christian anyway, and of course there's nothing wrong with that, but it sounds like extolling the merits of belief in God is something that comes naturally to him. I was impressed that Randall didn't just do the easy thing and offer attacks on atheism disguised as arguments for it. If there's no God, we can live however we want without moral accountability. Wouldn't that be nice? But Randall's arguments against God were fundamentally familiar, but clearer, simpler, and more eloquently stated than they are by most atheists who offer them. So anyway, congratulations to both guests for their generous spirit and uncommon fairness. I also agree very much with the general aim of this episode. Until you can explain your opponent's position in a way that they would approve of, you've not really ready to argue against it. Interesting stuff. Thank you very much for all the comments that have come in. It was very well received, that programme. Lots of people enjoyed the innovative format of getting them to swap sides. It's a kind of a bipolar kind of thing to do, though. Very hard to put yourself in the shoes of the other person and argue for their position. I'm still getting lots of feedback on the show from the week before, whether gay marriage is bad for children. Here's Stefan in Toronto says, I found the show very interesting, Bobby Lopez and James Croft. I agree with Mr. Croft's assertion that public policy and law must be based on sound scientific research and not simply anecdotal evidence. I find his conflation of those who dislike homosexuals and those who have concluded via study that gay families are not ideal to be reckless. It's perfectly valid to challenge, along methodological lines, the conclusions drawn from social science studies. However, too often, those who use the term hobophobe ascribe motives and attitudes to their opponents for which they have no factual evidence. It's intellectually lazy, not to mention reprehensible, to throw the term homophobe at those with whom one disagrees in order to shut down legitimate study and debate. Universities in the Western world are all too often becoming witch-hunting echo chambers for the dominant orthodoxies of the day, rather than being bastions of sound, independent inquiry and free speech. With respect to the academic proceedings against Mr. Lopez at the University of Texas, well, they'd do well to heed the approach of Voltaire, whose attitude was said by friends to be, "I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." Thank you very much. Here's one from Jeff in Canada. Says, this topic seems to be a difficult one to argue without pointing to some specific difference in the effects on the child. The way I see it, there may be grounds for a same-sex couple to argue they could bring more benefits generally than a heterosexual couple would as relates to raising a child. But where I believe they are lacking would be the gender-specific qualities necessary for rounded development that comes from a heterosexual family unit. And the question I would ask is whether or not a child's proper development requires that kind of environment. I thought the debate was a little one-sided and would have benefited greatly from a proponent with a biblical view on the issue. Anyway, thank you very much, and thanks to others who have been in touch with their thoughts on that programme. And thank you for getting in touch wherever you are, however you're listening in the world to Unbelievable. Don't forget to recommend it to friends. You can even rate it on iTunes if you listen via iTunes. Why not go on, give us a review? I've never ever asked for a review on iTunes in the history of this programme, but then I've noticed on other podcasts people regularly ask people to review and rate them. I guess that kind of makes you more noticeable on iTunes. So if you fancy doing that, feel free to do it and tell others what you think of the show. But you can always get in touch, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing from you that way and via the social media site and the website. In the meantime, I'm going to leave you with what's coming up next week on the programme.
You're unbelievable.
Well, we're going to be doing the programme that I sort of promised for you for this week. Are Christians happier than atheists? We're going to be looking at research that sometimes seems to suggest that people with religious beliefs or within religious communities are happier than those without. Well, sociologist Anne Morrissey is my Christian guest and will be joined by atheist writer Craig A. James. So look out for that show coming up on the radio and in your podcast feed at the same time next week. For the moment, I'll leave you with The Profile coming up next.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why my Lowe's Rewards members get a free paint or exterior stain sample to test your look and find the perfect color to confidently refresh your space. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid in-store only, 5/8 through 5/14. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See associate for details. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.